given that North Korean politics and political economy is my research specialty. One good thing about AST1 ICI, it's an inspiring subject. In the past, we've had students, especially here at this campus, but I'm sure in Melbourne as well, who've done this course, done this subject, and been inspired to travel to China, to travel to India. And in some cases, it's been a real life-changing and worldview-changing experience. So I hope that this subject, for those of you doing it this year, will be the same thing again. Today, we're all touched by China, whether we realise it or not. And this now is a critical time to know something about China for several reasons. For one, China is a critical trade partner for Australia. At the moment, we're also going through a power transition in international relations, a global hegemonic transition, where the power of the United States is beginning to wane, and it looks like Chinese power is becoming more ascendant, and we're in the middle of this phase shift in international affairs at the moment. So it's a very exciting time to be studying politics and international relations. It's a very exciting time to be alive because we're in the thick of this transition. China, as a consequence of this, is a key player in a new emerging global economy. We've seen the troubles that have been happening in the United States since 2008. We've seen the troubles that are happening right now in Europe. The goalposts of global economy are changing, and China looks to be a key player in what's emerging from that rubble. Another reason that we should know something about China is think of the large Chinese diaspora community that exists here in Australia. And you'd be hard-pressed to go anywhere in Australia without coming into contact with Chinese people and Chinese culture in one form or another. So Chinese cultural literacy, just like Indian cultural literacy, is a really important asset for any person, especially young people in Australia today. Now, you'll see in this lecture in particular, I'm going to show you a lot of maps. Now, maps are the political scientist and international relations specialist's best friend. They tell you a lot of things. Now, this map tells a lot of stories. So let's go through. Let's have a look. For one, if we look at some of the areas on the fringe, we can see that these provinces are what we call strategic buffer zones. They're evidence of past territorial expansion in Chinese history. And these are known as the autonomous regions in China today. There's also a story here of rapid industrial development. So if we look at the light green zones on the map, these are municipalities. These are some of China's megacities that have been given a special designation because of their importance to the national economy. If we look at the dark green special autonomous regions, these tell a story of China settling old historical scores, where territory has been taken away from Imperial China and is being reclaimed by the PRC today. Now, if we look at the shades of blue, we see ongoing territorial contests, particularly along the Indian frontier. I know Peter's talked a little bit about that in his lectures on India, and also with Taiwan. So the story of controversy in there. However, a political map doesn't tell you the whole story. China is staggering because of its sheer scale. And indeed, the modern Chinese state is the largest social engineering project in human history. First above India, which is also quite a big social engineering project. But let's consider some numbers here to put this into context. China has the world's largest population of 1.3 billion people. It's the world's fourth largest landmass, behind Russia, the United States, and Canada. It has the world's second largest economy, behind the US, and is slated to overtake the US in the not too distant future in terms of economy. China has the world's largest population of mobile phone users, at 747 million. It's got the world's largest population of internet users at 500 million. Mandarin Chinese is the world's most spoken language. Now, compare that with English speakers is 322 million versus 885 million speakers of Mandarin Chinese. China has the world's second largest military behind the United States. It's the world's second largest consumer of crude oil. It's the world's largest car market, and it's become the world's largest total emitter of greenhouse gases. So the scale of what's going on in China is huge. Despite its massive size and growing international clout, China reveals great diversity, and this is something we're going to explore in this lecture and beyond in the coming 6 weeks. So there's 4 points we're going to consider today. One, we're going to consider China's geographic diversity. We're going to consider China's ethnic and cultural diversity. We're going to consider China's economic diversity. And then we're going to see how all this plays out for China's natural environment and see that there's a real theme of man versus nature that characterizes Chinese economic development and the Chinese state's relationship with the geography that it occupies. So what does this all mean? What does it mean to be Chinese? What holds China together? And what challenges does China face? These are key questions for the lecture now. So bear these in mind as I progress through the talk. So let's start with China's geography now. On the slide here you see the iconic Razorback Mountains of Guilin, which are in Guangxi province in southern China. Often a lot of Chinese restaurants in Australia, you will see paintings that depict these mountains, very famous images. And a great place to start our talk on geography of China. Now, again, another map. Maps tell us a lot. This is a topographic map of China. And it tells us that China is divided, if you like, into four main geographic zones. So we've got the inner coastal fringe on the east. In the west, we have the outer steppe. In the north, it's very cool and dry. And in the south, it's warm and wet. So what are the geographic features we can see on this map? There's three major rivers, being the Yellow River, the Yangtze River, and the Pearl River in the south. There's mountain ranges. We've got the Himalaya, which is very prominent on this map. We've also got the Wuyi Range in the east, the Chenghua Range along the Korean frontier, and the Tian Range in Xinjiang province in the west. We've got deserts. We've got the Gobi Desert in the north, and the Ordos Desert, and the Taklamakan in the west in Xinjiang. Incidentally, Ordos was the site of this year's Miss World or Miss Universe pageant. I can't remember which one, but it's an interesting place to hold a beauty pageant on the edge of a desert. Also critical on this map, there's two major plains. So you've got the North China Plain, which is China's main agricultural base, and also the Manchurian Plain in the north. Geography is very important. Geography shapes land use patterns, which in turn shapes economies, which in turn shapes culture. So when you have diverse geography, you're also undoubtedly going to see diverse cultural patterns, diverse economic patterns. And that's definitely the pattern of development in China. So let's have a look more further. For thinking diversity, we can go from Mount Everest, which is the world's highest mountain, nearly 9,000 metres above sea level, down to the Turpan Depression, which is the world's lowest point at 150 metres below sea level. Let's contrast east versus western China, the inner coastal plain versus the outer steppe region. So coastal China, fertile river basins, home to two-thirds of China's population. Home to most of its industry and agriculture. It's a lightning rod for rural workers coming to find a better life in the city, coming to find better employment prospects. It's a lightning rod for people from the country coming to find better educational prospects. In short, it's a magnet for people looking for a slice of China's economic miracle. Now contrast this with steppe China, with rural China. which is rich in natural resources, but you know, further west you go, it's more sparsely populated. It's covered by mountains, hills, plateaus, and deserts, and it's not really as suited to intensive agriculture as coastal fringe of China. What about north versus south? The cold, dry north versus the warm south west. Warm west south, I should say. So northern China is more arid and it's cooler in terms of climate. So you see things like wheat as the dominant crop. So the food that tends to predominate in those areas is noodles and beer. Very tasty combination. Southern China, warmer and wetter climate. So what do you see there? More rice cultivation. So rice and rice wine is the alcoholic beverage of choice. If you ask me, I prefer the beer. Rice wine can be pretty nasty. So let's look at this in graphic form. Here's an average temperature map of China. And this illustrates the north versus south division quite starkly. So average temperatures in the south, much higher in the north, it's more cold. Let's have a look at an average rainfall map of China. And again, it tells a similar story. And what you see here is that the driest areas of China also tend to be the coldest areas of China. So particularly in the north and the west. What you see where the rainfall is the highest, you get most of the rain in the summer during the East Asian monsoon. Tend to be large rainfall dumping events. Let's have a look at agricultural production. And again, where the predominant agricultural regions are reflects where most of the rainfall falls and where the temperature regime is the best. And you can see, sort of clustered around the North China Plain, is the strongest and largest agricultural producing region in China. Alright, let's consider now the ethnic and cultural diversity of China. Now to do this, more maps. This is China, a map of China's population density. And you can see this illustrates the city versus rural and regional divide in China. Most people live in the east, in the coastal strip. Why is that? That's where most of the industrial development has taken place, and especially for China, which runs an export-oriented economy. If you're producing goods for export, you want to produce them in places that are close to the infrastructure for getting stuff out of the country. So port facilities on the coast, sending goods to the United States, sending goods to Europe and the Middle East, and even Australia. Makes sense that you cluster your economic development in places that are easy to export from. Conversely, this is a real challenge for regional centres the further west you go, because they're isolated from the global trade networks. So it's very difficult to attract investment to locations like that, because the cost of transporting anything from those regions is much higher. So exports are not competitive in terms of price from places in the regional hinterland. So what you get is a population drain. You get people moving from the regional centres, migrating to the coastal regions where employment prospects are better. So what you see is a population density map that looks exactly like the one we're looking at now. Now, interestingly, in terms of culture, let's look at this map, which is a map of China's ethnic composition. Now, of course, these maps are generalisations, but they do tell you a story. Now, it's no coincidence that China's population density is largest in one, the prime agricultural regions, two, the most economically developed regions, but these also tend to be predominantly Han Chinese by ethnicity. So the Han Chinese are China's largest ethnic group. They constitute 93% of the population. And they're clustered in this sort of Greater China area around the North China Plain. And that's traditionally been the population pattern there. Now, China is a multicultural country. China does have what you call a multicultural official policy on ethnicity. In an official discourse, China has 56 legally recognized ethnic groups, recognized nationalities called Minzu, who live together in a unitary multi-ethnic state. That's the official designation. So there are more groups than just the 56 ethnic nationalities in China, but the 56 on the list are those that are officially recognized by the Chinese state. Let's have a look at some of them now. For example, in the top left, you've got the Russian nationality. You've got the Tibetan nationality. You've got the E nationality of 6.5 million. And also ethnic Korean nationality. And that's a group that I've been familiar with in my travels there. Korean nationality called the Chaoshan Minzu, who I've had contact with in the Korean Autonomous Zone in Yangon in Jilin Province, up in the northeast. And it's a very interesting part of the world. I'm going to come back to that in a minute, so I won't steal too much thunder there. But these are some examples of some of the ethnic groups in China. Obviously, there's 52 more. What about the unofficial discourse of ethnicity in China? China is a rich cultural mosaic, a rich mosaic of linguistic, cultural, economic, and religious diversity, much more so than the official designation implies. And to probe this more, we have to think about diversity within the Han Chinese majority. So I've said the Han Chinese group constitute 93% of China's population by ethnicity. But who are these people? Who are the Han? Do they have a common language? Well, no, not entirely. There's great linguistic diversity across the country in Han Chinese areas. Do they have a common culture? Well, no, not exactly either. There's a lot of regionalization of cultural practices across China. Is there a common religion amongst the Han Chinese? Well, no, again, that varies depending on where you are. And is it a single ethnic group? Well, that's something that's open for debate also. Now, why do we ask these questions and why are they pertinent? It's because China's diverse geography begets different culture, different economy, according to where you are in China. So we can't, it's not strictly accurate to talk about the Han Chinese as one monolithic cultural group. China's geography dictates that there's going to be quite stark regional diversity within that group. Now, this map is of China's linguistic diversity, and again, note the kind of diversity that occurs within the Han Chinese ethnic heartland. So if we go back to the previous map, back here, so look at the Han Chinese heartland, according to ethnicity, in the eucalyptus green there. Now, fast forward back to this map, and you see that the linguistic diversity is much more varied than what the ethnicity map would suggest. So what this indicates is, yes, across China there's regional dialects of language. There's also other languages outright. Even though they share a common script, the common Chinese pictograms, as far as speaking and talking goes, these languages tend to be quite different. And for someone, for a tourist like me or a visitor who goes there, I can tell an example of where I went to Taiwan and started speaking classical Mandarin at shops there. No one knew what the hell I was talking about, and I didn't know what they were saying because the dialect was much different. And that's common. You go to the south of China, people talk in different dialects to they do in the north. What about cultural diversity? We see a lot of variation in China, for example, in the field of food, in this regional cuisine. I think there's four or five distinctive Chinese regional cuisines. My favourite is the hot spicy food of Sichuan province in the west. It uses a lot of chilli, very tasty, love it. You see regionally distinct styles of music and opera styles that are very distinct across the country. You see unique cultural festivals. So one of the ones I've got depicted on the slide is the Harbin Ice Sculpture Festival, which is held every winter in Harbin in Heilongjiang province in the north. One of my favourites. Again, you couldn't have this in the south where it's warm. And so, not surprisingly, the kind of cultural festivals you see in there are much different. Regionally, you see different burial and marriage customs and other cultural customs. They vary. And also there's regional stereotypes. If you think of it in terms of language as a regional variant, one that I've come across is the distinctive Beijing accent, which I've been told is like a cross between a kung fu movie and a pirate to the western ear, a lot of rawr. Now, I know it sounds ridiculous, but you have to hear it, and it's very distinctive when you travel somewhere else and hear Mandarin spoken. The linguistic difference is very easy on the ear to notice. Now, religious diversity. Generally in China, religion is tolerated so long as the practice is predominantly held in private and that the religious group doesn't challenge the authority of the state in any way. So let's have a look. Let's go through some of the pictures on the slide here. So we've got older Eastern thought systems, which have more in common with philosophies or thought systems as opposed to our traditional view of religion here in the West. So for one, you've got Taoism, which originates in about the 4th century BC, founded by a man called Lao Tzu. And you can find his writings are widely available now in the West, and an interesting read. There's Confucianism, founded by Confucius, or as we know him, Confucius. That originated in the 5th century before 5th century BC. China had Buddhism, which arrived from India in around the 3rd century BC. All of these not generally classifiable as religions in a strict Western sense of the word, but there's a lot of philosophical and metaphysical overtones here that we're not used to. In terms of the Abrahamic religions that we are used to in the West, Islam arrived via the Silk Road in the 7th century AD. We see here Christianity came also in the 7th century AD on the Silk Road. Also, a bit later in the 16th century, came with Christian missionaries from Europe. The picture you see on the slide here in the middle on the bottom is the Beigang Cathedral in Beijing, which was of interest to me because it was laid siege to during the Boxer Rebellion in 1901. And also there are some people of Judaic religion in China as well. What we see here is the Kaifeng Synagogue in Kaifeng in Hunan province. Known as the Lost Jews of Kaifeng, these people are also said to arrive in China around the 7th century AD along the Silk Road. So historically here we see the Silk Road, this highway of trade between China and the Middle East and then on to Europe, as a highway of ideas and a highway of religion as well, which has been open on and off for over a couple of thousand years. So this begins a real religious diversity across China that's not always obvious to the external observer. Now, with this diversity, I talked about religion being okay as long as it doesn't challenge the authority of the state. Well, because China is ethnically diverse, because there are regions that have been added to Greater China, you know, over the last 500 or so years as buffer regions, we do get some groups who would like to cleave off from the Chinese state. We have other groups that are striving for greater self-determination within the orbit of the Chinese state. So I've talked about the Chaosheng Minzu, the ethnic Koreans that I've had contact with in my research activities. Now, for a lot of these people, they feel like they're in an identity conflict, where they're ethnically and culturally Korean. Korean's the mother language that they speak at home and use predominantly, but they're also Chinese citizens and they're trying to fit in into the Chinese state. And so there's an identity conflict, dual loyalties at the heart, if you like, that makes it quite difficult for them on occasion. There's also sometimes can be economic discrimination in favour of Han Chinese over some of these other ethnic groups, which the other Minzu have to struggle against from time to time. There are, however, elements within, particularly the Tibetan community and the Uyghur community in Xinjiang, who are fighting for not just self-determination, but to actively separate from the Chinese state and get independence. This is what's referred to as splitism in official discourse. And the Chinese security apparatus, as you can imagine, keeps a very close eye on any splitist activity. So you recall from 2008, during the Olympic torch relay that went around the world, and there was a lot of pro-Tibet demonstrations, including here in Canberra in Australia. And the Chinese security apparatus, and both explicitly and undercover, was very active in trying to keep the torch relay safe and trying to minimise the impact of these pro-Tibet protests around the world. So it's a very good example of the ethnic politics at play. It affects the diaspora, the Chinese diaspora, as well as within China as well. So let's move on now to China's economic diversity. The picture here that you can see is of the skyline of Shanghai looking across the Yangtze River. Very impressive, almost sci-fi, Blade Runner-esque. And it's very symbolic of China's economic miracle. But also it's not a miracle that's shared by all Chinese. So I talked about the concentration of wealth on the coastal fringe of China. So let's look at this map here. It's a map of GDP by province, so gross domestic product. Look where the concentrations of wealth are. It's very clear where the predominant zones of development are located. And these dark green regions really are the locus of global economic production in these days, the engine of China's export-led economy, and of course the base for China's ocean-based foreign trade. They are symptomatic of China's rapid industrialisation. Now, one thing we have to remember about China is China is still in the midst of the Industrial Revolution. Industrialisation started in the West 150 to 200 years ago. In China, it's been taking place in the last 50 years, so the type of changes we're seeing here are very rapid. So there is a potential here for social dislocation. Think of what happened when people moved off the land en masse in England and in Europe in the 19th century, the type of social dislocations that created during that time. We're seeing a similar movement of people from the regions to the cities in China today. So there is this potential for similar kinds of social unrest. This is an interesting map that gives us some perspective on the size of the Chinese economic miracle. This is a comparison of China's provinces with other countries around the world that have an equivalent GDP or equivalent rates of economic growth. So Australia's GDP is comparable to that of Zhejiang province. So you look on the east coast, around just to the south of Shanghai. Another comparison, Indonesia's GDP is equivalent to the municipality of Shanghai. So Shanghai's economy is the same size as the entire country of Indonesia. I mean, that's staggering scale. So that gives you a real appreciation for the scale and the size of the Chinese economy. How does that play out in education? Well, again, you would expect to see in the areas with the greatest concentrations of wealth, you would also see the greatest concentration generations of educated people. Why is that? That's because complex economic activity requires people with higher levels of education. And that's exactly what we see here on the education map. And I was inspired to use this map after Peter used the Indian Railway map in his first witness lecture. And railways are instructive. Railways tell you about the concentration of people and wealth. So where there's lots of people and where there's lots of money, you will expect a tighter web of railway networks, which is no surprise. Now, railways were brought to China by Europeans and the Japanese at the start of the 20th century. But they've expanded greatly since that time, including the highest railway line in the world, which goes up into Tibet, and which is one of China's great economic achievements, development achievements of recent times. Now, it's interesting, if you compare this map to an Australian railway map, which is like very sparse, there's hardly any railways in Australia. And that's because Australia does not have the concentrations of population that China has. So Australia's railway map is anemic compared to what we see on this graphic here. Let's do some further comparisons. City versus country. A tale of two regions. All the indicators that I've pointed to here show that there's this great disparity between the regions and the developed coastal fringe. So on the bottom, we've got some pictures. On the bottom, you've got rural Henan province. So residents here have a per capita income of approximately $700 per year in 2010. Compare that with the average resident of Beijing, where people have an annual per capita income of $10,000 per year. So there's a very stark income disparity between these two regions. And it plays out, the pictures are very representative here. Rural agrarian versus modern industrial. These economic developments have socio-political consequences. One, as I've alluded to, is the great migration of people from rural regions to the cities. As many as 200 million people have left regional areas, a surplus population of rural labourers. So in the city, when you go to see mass construction projects in a place like Beijing or Shanghai, almost all of the labourers will be economic migrants that have come from the country to the city looking for work. Now, the consequence of that, when you've got this enormous pool of unskilled surplus labour, it means that these people can be employed for very low wages, with very poor working conditions, because there's so many of them, they don't have the leverage to improve their employment conditions. So that's why development activity in Chinese cities can occur very rapidly. So here we have an 8-hour day and construction stops. In China you can run three consecutive shifts running 24/7. Things get done, get built very quickly in China in a way that's not possible in Australia. That's very noticeable. Another thing that is noticeable to the trained observer is there's been a sharp rise in social unrest over the last 10 to 20 years in association with this great rural migration and concentration of people in the cities. Something like 120,000 mass incidents occurring in 1 year. So a mass incident can be anything from a small protest about village-level corruption up to something more serious like a riot, something we saw in Urumqi in Xinjiang a few years ago. Earlier this year, we saw something very interesting that will be of concern to the Chinese government, where a village called Wukan in Guangdong province was occupied by its residents, and the security personnel kicked out of the village. in protest against corruption by the local village heads. Now, this was an unprecedented social uprising in modern China. And something, if we see more of this, then it's very indicative of a general trend in social unrest. But look that up, it's a really interesting story. In reaction to this growing trend, we're seeing official government policy, the Go West policy, where the central government is trying to funnel investment into the regions in the West, trying to build up economic activity in the regional centres, to try and decrease the need for people to migrate to the cities, keep people in place where they are by pumping investment in these regional centres. However, as we've seen from the maps, geography is not on the side of this policy, simply because these places are too far away from the global networks of trade to make them cost competitive as centres for export economics, for export activity. It's just simply too difficult. So that's a problem for the Go West policy. Now, the environment. This is a picture I took from an apartment, the 36th floor of an apartment in Beijing a few years ago. I often like to say that in a Chinese city you can look at the sun for 10 minutes without blinking because the air pollution is so thick. Now, that is a mildly facetious statement, but it does tell you something about the air quality in Chinese cities. And in a way, this is emblematic of a lot of China's environmental problems. Now, there's many contributing factors to China's economic environmental ills. One of these is a remnant of communist ideology. The idea of man as the master of his own destiny. Man is capable of reshaping nature. This is something you see, an attitude to the human relationship with the natural world that is evident across communist bloc countries. North Korea is my primary research focus, and that's something that's very evident there in the way that economic development takes a pathway that's not cognizant at all of its impacts on the natural realm. This also coincides with the quest for rapid economic development. As I've said, the Chinese Industrial Revolution has been rapid over the last two decades in particular. That quest for rapid economic development has its genesis in national pride and wanting to bring China out of a poor agrarian phase and to make it a strong and powerful country. But often that's a reification, if you like, of economic development as something as a quasi-religious activity, and you see this in other developing countries too, leads economic development activities to be privileged over other things like safety, over other things like environmental impacts and workers' rights. So it's no surprise then that you get to see some of these terrible environmental impacts. Another issue is the sheer logistics of accommodating and servicing over 1 billion people. Every person has a consumption footprint. Every person has needs and wants that have to be serviced through the economy. All economic activity requires the consumption of resources and the production of pollution of some kind. So clearly, an expanding population necessitates some form of environmental degradation in order to accommodate that. So the population issue is quite a driver that's influencing environmental carnage in China. So is this a crisis? Or is this something that's just normal in industrial societies? Is there something about the Chinese experience that's particularly special, or is this just something that's a consequence of the industrial process? Well, 16 of the world's most polluted cities exist in China. including Linfang, which is the world's most polluted city. What we see in the picture here, with rubbish everywhere, is a consequence of what happens sometimes with rapid urbanisation and industrialisation, is that the logistics of municipal hygiene tend to lag behind the prerogatives of economic development. So recall the dirtiness of the slums of English cities in the Industrial Revolution. Now, I'm willing to bet that modern Chinese cities are not nearly as bad as what we saw in England in the 19th century during the Industrial Revolution in terms of dirtiness and lack of hygiene and environmental degradation. But you get the picture. It's a consequence of concentrating a lot of people in one place very quickly, and then the infrastructure to support them, including waste disposal, tends to grow around them over time and with agitation from the people themselves, because they get sick of living in conditions like that. So this is a process that's ongoing in China now, and it's one of the things that leads to some of these mass incidents that I was talking about. Air pollution. I just talked about that before. I do laugh that smog is euphemistically called fog in official weather forecasts and weather broadcasts, when really it's almost entirely particulate pollution from industrial activity. Now, there's lots of reasons why the air quality is really bad in Chinese cities. One of them is the consequence of coal-fired power generation. So China is a country that's rich in coal resources, so there is a perverse economic incentive there for coal-fired power generation to be the predominant form of electricity generation in this country. We also see this as the consequence of a rapid increase in smog emissions from industrial processes. More factories, more smog. Easy arithmetic. It also comes from a rapid increase in the number of cars on the roads in Chinese cities. So 25 years ago, China, and Beijing in particular, was renowned as a city of bicycles, where people got around on bikes all the time. Now, that's not so much the case. Having a car is a sign of status. Having a car makes it easier to get around, in a lot of cases, if you have to travel a long distance. So there's a real proliferation in the number of car owners and car drivers in China. There's also a proliferation in the number of roads to service those car drivers. The final thing that contributes to this air pollution is also the burning of raw coal for domestic heating purposes. Now, if you burn coal domestically, it's a very dirty source of fuel. And again, if you look back at the 19th century experience of European cities, part of the City of London's issue was that coal was used as a domestic heating source, and it was horrible for air quality. And we do see some of that in China today, although not to the same degree. But nonetheless, what we get is often air that's of a terrible quality, which has health effects, among other things. This is an interesting graphic. This is a satellite picture of smog pouring out from the cities of Beijing and Tianjin. You can see the Bohai Gulf on the right, which is the body of water, and just a tremendous amount of air pollution here from these two very big industrial cities in China's north. It very much illustrates the story I'm trying to portray here. But China has other environmental issues that are pertinent here. One is soil erosion and desertification. Now, the Chinese capital of Beijing is only 160 kilometres from the edge of an encroaching desert in the northeast. And this desert line moves southward about 3 kilometres a year. So the desert is encroaching in on the Chinese capital. Now, why is that happening? There's a number of reasons. One is poor land management. So, farming practices, the expansion of agricultural land, or the use of land for agriculture at the expense of natural vegetation. So you pull out what are quite diverse forest ecosystems or natural scrubland, take that out and put in a monocrop. That's likely to erode. The soil is likely to be degraded at a much faster rate than the natural system, which makes it a lot easier for the desert to encroach. Also, deforestation. The more forest you pull out, the easier it is for the soil to degrade and turn into desert. So these two human factors, if you like, about how land is managed really have a big influence on how fast the desert can encroach. So we're talking about the Gobi Desert in the northeast, and it's moving in part because of human activity and how land is used and abused. The other factor at play here is climate change. Now, as the global concentrations of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere increase, average temperatures go up in unison with that. And what we're seeing is climate zone boundaries tend to move as global as regional temperature regimes change. So the desert agricultural region boundary is not just a boundary on the land, it's a climate zone boundary between the arid region and the more temperate agricultural region. So as the climate gets warmer, this also accelerates the desertification process as the climate zone boundary moves southward. Now, this is not just something that we see in China. This is happening around the world. It's happening in Australia with the movement of climate change boundaries. But human activity can go a long way to accelerating this process. So we're seeing natural and human processes in tandem here leading to soil degradation and the encroachment of the desert on agricultural areas. So you can see what happens. As this encroaches on farmland, as the desert encroaches on farmland, where you get increasing drought because of water quality, that decreases agricultural yields, leads to higher food prices. So if there's less food available by farmers growing within China, it means Chinese people have to access food from international markets and import more. Now, because of the scale of China's food needs, when that happens, it increases food prices on international markets because there's more people competing for that international pool of food, which has an impact on poorer countries who get priced out of international food markets because prices go up. So this issue of soil degradation in China is one that has international significance, not just for the people living on the ground in these regions. Water scarcity and water pollution is another big issue, particularly in urban areas. Now, we saw on the maps, particularly on the rainfall maps before, that most of China's rainfall and most of China's water supplies exist in the south of the country. The problem is there's a greater proportion of the population live in the more arid and dry north of the country. So there's a mismatch between where the water is and where the people are. On top of this, the water supply for about half of China's population is contaminated by animal and human wastes. On top of that, water demand has increased by about 8% since 1997, and it's projected to rise by about 20% by the year 2030. So, factors at play here. Demand for water in China is rising. The amount of water available is decreasing because it's being used up, because of climatic factors, and also because it's being polluted. So what we're seeing here is that up to 90% of stream flows in rivers in China are diverted for human use. 90%. And that's well above the figure of 30 to 40% of stream flow that set as a safe limit for maintenance of healthy aquatic ecosystems by international scientific bodies. So if you think about the Murray-Darling Basin, this is about 30 to 40% diversion for human use. In China, 90%. So you can imagine the kind of impact this has on the quality of China's water resources. And again, that's a big problem. So what are some of the economic costs then of this environmental degradation? Some estimates put it at approximately 8 to 10% of annual GDP growth is lost because of environmental degradation. 8 to 12% annual GDP. So there's an economic cost to this. There's a social cost of environment-based mass incidents, social unrest. Because people are demanding better water, because people are demanding better air quality. There's also the health impacts. So you can imagine when you have to live in a city that's highly polluted with air pollution, there's a lot of respiratory illnesses that go around. When people get sick, it costs them money to get treated. And if you're poor, or you don't have the financial resources to access the hospital system, then that can take you out of the workforce. It's not the same social safety net that exists elsewhere. So getting sick can have a massive impact on your life prospects. Now, it's not all doom and gloom when we're talking about the Chinese environment. China is now a world leader in renewable energy resources. Now, why might that be the case? One, to wean off coal-fired power. China is a country that's very much exposed to climate change impacts. The government is aware of this, and they're aware that to bring their emissions footprint down, they have to get off coal-fired power. They're also, because of their expanding economy, energy security is an issue here. Importing oil from the Middle East through possibly insecure sea lanes is a strategic vulnerability. So renewable energy is a way to get around that problem. Have your own energy resource that's clean, kills two birds with one stone, environmental protection plus addressing strategic vulnerability. It's also why you see now solar energy, wind energy. China is a leader in these industries around the world. China has the world's largest nuclear reactor at Yangjing in southern Guangdong province. So again, a cleaner energy source, a non-fossil fuel energy source. China has the world's largest solar power plant in Qinghai province. You can see that in the top corner of the slide there. Same deal. China also has a growing revolution in electric bicycles. People getting around cities trying to get away from car transport for all the many problems that that causes on electric bikes, but also a little bit faster than your average pushy. So that's China's environment. So I'm going to wrap this up now and ask a few questions. What does this all mean? What does this great diversity of the Chinese state mean? Let's tie it up. Are China's geographic, ethnic, economic and environmental cleavages a strength or a weakness? What does this mean for social cohesion? What does this mean for China's economic miracle? What does this mean for China's environmental sustainability? What does all this mean for the Chinese Communist Party's rule and for the stability of the Chinese state? We're going to explore all of these questions in greater depth as we move through the subject for the remainder of these next 6 weeks. And this is just a taster. But this can go two ways. You can look at the diversity of the Chinese state as a strength, or you can look at it as a number of cross-cutting social and economic and political cleavages that weaken the centralised control of the Chinese state. We look at Chinese history, we see cycles of centralisation and of the country breaking apart over, you know, several thousand years. Are these cleavages, are these potential problems something that could force the decentralisation and the blowing apart of the central control of the Communist Party? As we move further into the 21st century, internationally the world is beset by a number of big macro problems. Things like climate change, things like energy insecurity and peak oil, things like the global sovereign debt crisis, issues like overpopulation. All of these things are coalescing at the same time. All of these things are providing great challenges to all countries. They're threat multipliers. So if you're a country that has any pre-existing weaknesses or divisions, these big macro problems together are likely to exacerbate those domestic problems and make governments that much harder. So this is a big challenge for China. We've talked about China as the biggest social engineering project in human history, coming at a time which is a historic inflection point in human history where a number of global problems are coalescing together at the same time. So these five questions on the board, I want you to ponder these based on what I've said today, based on what we're going to explore in the next 5 weeks, and hopefully that'll give you a greater appreciation of the Chinese state, the Chinese people and Chinese culture, and where China is headed in the future. So we're wrapping up a little bit early this week, but next week we're going to look at Chinese history, and this is a very rich story on Chinese history. So thank you very much.